I'm really happy to have Dale Smith here. I have two of his books in my hands that have meant a lot to me. He's not reading from either of these. Blackstone was a gift to me when I was writing my book, Ironstone Whirligig, as a blog when I had young children and was dealing with life, daily life, and trying to fit it all in. You can see it's marked in places because I've used it. But more importantly, my vote counts. There's a stain here. That's beer. There was an election several years ago where a kid who graduated from high school just a couple years after I did was running for mayor. I didn't like him. He was the sort of guy that remembered a jazz solo and played it over and over again on the saxophone. We were in the jazz band together in high school. And the night of the election, I cornered him on the smoking deck of the rum line and read this entire book to him. So he didn't win. But that is my introduction for Dale Smith. I'm excited to hear anything he has to say because he matters in my world.
Really lovely. Yeah, there's a goat and my vote counts. Vote goat. I'm really, really happy to be here and grateful to Henry and to Amanda and everyone. I don't know if I should stay. I think I'm gonna sit.
Yes,
probably. And I'm going to grab my glasses, actually. Oh, they're right there. I'm here tonight with these two books that I spent the last, I don't know, 6-7 years on, the Duncan Olson correspondence and then Duncan's lectures on Olson, given over a 20-year period. And if you don't have them, you're welcome to come check these out afterwards. I'm happy to talk to you. The thing about them, in one sense, so I'll explain this in the talk. I'll read, but in one sense, it's an academic work where you have to go in and look through the archives and, you know, prepare the footnotes and do your diligence with this stuff. But the reason I did it and the reason I do anything is because I want a world that matters and has meaning and isn't full of what Robert Duncan calls the raving mania that a nation is. And I feel like their correspondence, the poetry of Robert Duncan and Charles Olson, is an attempt to give North Americans a language to find meaning in the world. And so this is where I'm coming from with this. I'm going to read this talk, and I'll interrupt myself and read a bit from the letters and interrupt myself anyway, because I tend to interrupt myself. But I tend to be a prepared speaker, so I'm prepared. And there's also like acknowledgments and love in this that I want to be able to address. And I call this the circle of the beehive, and which will make sense as I think it goes on. And I talked to my good friend Roberto Tejada, and I'm like, man, how do you talk to human beings? How do you go prepare a way to speak to people with all of this stuff you want? And he's like, just start with what you desire. What do you want? I'm like, all right, I can do that. So, all right. My desire is to cultivate a world of our own making in words, to determine the pathways and dimensions of that world according to our shared enthusiasms, and to prepare a space for the reception of what Charles Olson knew as love. Love is form, and love is an embrace of the conflicted reality of our various selves cast to the appetites of nation and globe. In poetry, I have sought many pathways for more than 20 years, desiring, above all, an advancement of conversations and an exchange of perspectives. I've pursued the divisiveness of the gestures of speech and print to clarify positions in poetry, to open capacities, and to define my abilities as an artist and thinker. And I think Amanda was talking, the poetry that I've worked on for years, the magazines and stuff, has been to like open up space and to provoke conversation. With Hua Nguyen, I began as a poet and an editor of a little magazine and book imprint, the cheekily entitled Skanky Possum. I later pursued a PhD at the University of Texas at Austin, where I earned professional advancement as a scholar of rhetorical theory and history and of poetics and public culture. And later, when Robert Bertolf asked me to assist him with the letters of Robert Duncan and Charles Olson, I took a crash course in textual scholarship. And this collection down the street would have helped me a lot, especially after he passed away, sadly. While disciplinary training produces specific outlooks toward text, I'm motivated by the dynamic cultural range sounded in Robert Duncan's words, kind and kin. He said these in a June 1955 letter to Charles Olson, confirming the difficulties and necessities of social obligation. Kind and kin, an acknowledgement of difference and the cultivation of affinities within that difference, is sounded too in what Olson called a circle of the beehive or umphalos. He wondered how any of us is a closed circle which opens solely when the inhabitants are known, that there is no out until the in is done. I hear in Olson's circle of the beehive and in Duncan's kind and kin a redirection of energy and attention away from the strictly material lines of force animating coteries and creative scenes. There is something more bracing and fundamental here that requires an increase in awareness of larger scopes of human connectivity. Perhaps the figurative stature of the umphalos, an egg-shaped or hive-shaped stone found at holy sites in ancient Greece, enables an imagination of a temporal placement and duration that Walter Benjamin understood as the time of the now. The umphalos, this is from Jane Harrison, right? The stone at Delphi that would have had, like, looks like bees could have covered around it. It's like a beehive. It's beautiful. This now, this beehive, is striated with past and future, all contained in the living we do here, in the what Olson says is the matter and the means of our limits, in his correspondence with Duncan. And I love that, like this sense of our own limit, acknowledging our limits as a way to access a much larger reality. Robert Bertolf, my co-editor of An Open Map, the correspondence of Robert Duncan and Charles Olson, died in early 2016. And in the time since his passing, the reverberations of his loss have become unsettled in the wreckage that encroaches on the time of our now, our circle of the beehive. Here in what my friend Roberto Tejada, building on Naomi Klein's diagnosis of large-scale shocks to society, refers to as opportunistic accumulations of corporate and private wealth, the preservation of whiteness and toxic masculinity, assaults on immigrants and indigenous rights, anti-black violence and other forms of racial aggression and religious intolerance, unpredictable levels of cyber surveillance and the single-minded repeal of our social safety nets. While these current political and social manifestations are unique to our shared experience, the larger history of North American violence is not. Duncan, in 1961, saw in his own political era, quote, merchants and manufacturers with their hired advertising men who have perverted all goods, the usurers and gamblers in the money markets with their rentiers, the liberals and reactionaries, the political mercenaries, the excited peace workers and the warmongers who have lost all sense of the immediate life, living as they do like lice upon the threat of disorder and the heat of conflict in their host. Fuck. Against kind and kin, he acknowledged the raving mania that a nation is. I offer these tensions, the raving mania of the nation, against the circle of the beehive, as a way to acknowledge our efforts to make art in volatile conditions, because energy is form, as Duncan and Olson understood it, and form is not an object, but a dispensation of attention. And in parentheses, I say spirit, the question mark. Love is form, Olson said early in the Maximus poems, and cannot be without important substance. And there is a sorrow that moves through me with the immediate losses of those we love. Joanne Kiger, Bill Berkson, David Meltzer, Jack Collum, Tom Raworth, Garrett Lansing, all recently gone from this world, these friends and figures of an outward-focused creative urgency, expanded meaning in a world shot through with the pain and madness of North American disfigurement. In poetic traditions mapped out by Duncan and Olson, their work remains living occasions, showing how to inhabit with grace the grim conditions in our time of the now. I'm thinking today about Ralph Maud, just down the street with the collection that he put, like, crazily put together, like collecting Olson's library and the footnotes in this thing, the dedication and love involved in one's pursuit of sustaining, I think, a livable world, right? Which is, it's not a radical, it's super conservative, just necessity, right? To be in a world that matters is for some reason a hard fucking thing. And that there are people in absolute pursuit of this, it humbles me still. And so part of my work on this has been to like be able to acknowledge that and try to draw this into the present reality as much as possible. And even given this loss, right, the sorrow of individual loss is confronted with the sorrow of the violent assault, the manifest destiny of cash that is the god of North American business culture. The raving mania of the nation, as Ned and Constance Sublett show in American Slave Coast, A History of the Slave Breeding Industry. This is an amazing book, came out in 2015. It derives from the crazed policies of human ownership and trafficking, suppressed as the fundamental motive for nationhood since the inception of the Republic and before. The historian Jill Lepore asks, who are the people and who speaks for them? And the mania intensifies as the plurality of a people succumbs to the corruption of representative council. Who is a poet, and how do poets speak into the noise? Tonight I want to talk about the circle of the beehive and share some of the work I've done in the context of our now as a way to confront a sorrow that accompanies the immediate and historic reality we inhabit as North Americans. So I want to acknowledge these conditions, some forms that give shape to thoughts and feelings, and bring to those thoughts and feelings a reminder of what Robert Duncan and Charles Olson defined as an open form poetics at mid-century. Because in their writing and in their private correspondence, they worked out the terms of this beehive from the personal grounds of their actions as poets and citizens of a particular moment in history. And it is the cosmological and social acknowledgement of their moment and their history that gives hope to our work today. Robert Duncan and Charles Olson first met in 1947 on the campus of the University of California, Berkeley, at the urging of no less than Ezra Pound, who both men had visited on separate trips to St. Elizabeth's in Washington, D.C. Duncan, a California native, would have been 28 years old and was then enrolled in the Medieval Studies program headed by Ernst Kantorowicz. He had lived on both coasts, forming close literary ties to a diverse range of writers from Anais Nin and Henry Miller to Kenneth Patchen and Pauline Kael. He also had published an influential essay, The Homosexual in Society, in Dwight MacDonald's journal Politics, and his first book of poems, Heavenly City, Earthly City, appeared around the time he met Olson. By contrast, the New England poet scholar was 36 years old when he met Duncan, and he had recently abandoned a high-profile job at the Democratic Party to concentrate his efforts on writing. Earlier, he had completed his work for a PhD at Harvard, where he studied with the historian Frederick Merck and literary critic F.O. Matheson in the American Civilizations Program, as it was then called. He did not complete his dissertation, writing instead an astonishing book about Herman Melville and the American experience titled Call Me Ishmael, and Ezra Pound helped him publish it. With that work behind him, Olson traveled west in late summer 47 to conduct research on the California Gold Rush, with particular interest in Western settlement and the Donner Party. Although his work as a poet articulates most profoundly the geographic and spiritual location of Gloucester, Massachusetts, in the Maximus poems, Olson's range of interests and concerns include not only North American history, but also Sumerian, ancient Greek, Mayan, and European sources. Like Duncan, whose interest in religion and the occult formed a primary ground on which an encounter with poetry could begin, Olson's wide-ranging investigation of myths from many cultures sustained a lifelong curiosity for the roots of human actions in the world. And this sense of action, I think, is really important, right? It's not like these aren't studies in like the archive of human history, but a study in how do we retain and retransmit and re-execute the actions of our past, our culture, who we are. The history of who we are is dynamic and living and ongoing, right? So it's not like that's the part of Olson that really also comes out in these letters. For instance, Robert Duncan, in a 1964 lecture on Charles Olson, published in the companion volume here, Imagining Persons, remembers their first meeting. And this is Duncan. He says, "We had two or three afternoons in Berkeley. Olson had looked me up because he had read a collection of poems called Medieval Scenes. All I knew when this giant, he was 6'8", descended upon me was, well, a poet feels good when someone's interested in your poetry." But then we talked about ecology. Actually, we talked about cities and farms and how this was a subject I was filled with at the time. It seemed to me a vital thing that had happened in history. I draw attention to this opening scene in their friendship because it is not at all a literary occasion. Duncan says that together they continued talking about the relationship of rural agriculture to cities, both in medieval times and in the immediate aftermath of World War II in Europe. They offered each other questions about the world, about the history behind the post-war conditions they were just beginning to encounter in 1947. It's the same like thing of ongoing war we're dealing with now in our contemporary moment. They articulated an interest in actions and things and regions or precincts of study, their forms, what kind of history will I tell, what shape will it take, had not been worked out entirely. Instead, they acknowledged each other's pursuits and compared their locales, or what both later referred to via the Greek historian Jane Harrison as a taminos, that beehive again, the ground of interests and curiosities from which forms emerge. And I gave a talk on a panel a week or so ago in San Francisco. I was talking about this taminos. I said this is more important than form, like the you know, projective verse and all that, the formal side of it, trying to articulate open verse, that's really cool. But really, in these letters and what their conversation is about is like, how do you, like, what is it that, what do we love and how do we bring that into the world? Right? How do we like, not like perform as literary, you know, figures or poet, but just be human beings in the world and bring that out in the way that makes most sense? And so that intensity, that intense looking at the precinct, the taminos, the ground under your feet, to me, is the most important thing that is rarely talked about in literary studies. There are literary studies that want to talk about form and the history of the sonnet from Petrarch and all that shit, and which is fine. But there's other stuff, right? And we're also in this new context in North America, and I think that's something that Olson and Duncan were, in 1947, were just like struck with. Like, also that war was horrific, and it's changed everything, and we're in it, that change. And so they were looking at it. I have a lot I could say about some contemporary stuff that is going on. I'll say at the end of this, actually. Talk about it a bit more. Okay, so I'm a digressive speaker. Letters soon appeared between them after those 1947 meetings. And the correspondence continued until Olson's death in 1970. So I'll read two brief letters from Olson, who opens the correspondence soon after his first face-to-face conversations with Duncan. And I offer them as an entry to the sound of the language and as an introduction to the textures of speech conveyed. So just to give you a sense of where they're going, I'll just read a little bit from the... And I'll describe some... It was like 40 footnotes in the first two. I'll describe those after. I'll just read them so you can hear them. And I can't even remember the footnotes. This is the first one's from September 9, 47. Olson's writing Duncan from Los Angeles on September 9th. Dear Duncan. He's so dramatic. Dear Duncan. Christ and Robert Duncan will know whether the enclosed is of any use. Anyhow, felicitations. I was back in San Fran one night last week and met Muriel Rukeyser. If you have not already, add her to your sponsors. She's warm about you. And advise if Ezra Pound notion worked. A note right back to me, which you might do and reprieve me for delay, would catch me before I head east. Care of Sean, 673 Broadway, Venice. Remember me and Constance, his wife, and Jane, your Niobe, and beg to excuse no visit to Van Fra. I don't have no idea who Van Fra is, but that's footnote here. On the Tuesday I was to go, I looked at traveler's checks and saw that many, M-E-N-E, it's Book of Daniel reference, like the writing on the wall. I'm making fast for Washington base. Let me hear from you. Yours, Olson. And the next letter is Robert. It's from Los Angeles a few months later. Robert, I pulled out fast. Dramatic dash. Broke. And this time I'm gone. The last 5 days I carried your black book back and forth, San Francisco to Berkeley. I took the freedom to leave it as most safe among the other historic transcripts at the Bancroft, the library in Berkeley. If you'll call on Eleanor Bancroft herself, she has it. Because they were already at this point exchanging poems, notebooks, information. And this is before the internet. I mean, there was no copy, so they're leaving it behind, you know, so they can get it. Read it all. At the moment, haven't a thing to say, except I think you are wonderful. But that doesn't do you a bit of good. Read Miss Gertrude Stein on bomb. It's a letter to reference on the nuclear bomb. I shall compose you a letter. Do likewise yours, Olson. Anyway, that's a kind of sense of the correspondence opening up, right? It's like an immediate, like, they're involved in each other's life. They're sympathetic. There's a shared... ground on which they can start a conversation. So in these opening missives, you sense Olson's urgency in colloquial jargon. Washington, D.C. isn't home, it's base. It is lovely. Very Cold War. although immediate figures like Van Fraas has been lost to memory and to history, biblical references like many from the Book of Daniel, the handwriting on the wall, show easy familiarity with religious scripture. Olson's Catholic background and study of literature and mythology, and Duncan's esoteric religious upbringing and the Order of the Hermetic Brotherhood of Oakland. No shit, right? It's like this guy like grew up in this family of hermeticists. It was his bread and butter, right? So he would have known mythology and very esoteric religious stuff from the beginning, inflected in this very Western California tradition, right? There's a whole lot more to say to that that we could talk about. But this combined, I think, sense of mythos in life, right? That the mythology and religion as not just this thing you have to learn and memorize for scholastic reasons or church, but as like integrated into a reality that we might share as a way to symbolic patterns of exchange, right? Were important to them. They made it uniquely attuned them to religious and mythological references in the letters, and you can see it throughout the correspondence. They have these sort of short, quick notes back and forth to each other where they assume each other's knowledge of this stuff, among other things. In an era with no instantaneous messaging, physical addresses are necessary markers of individual contact, so Olson leaves forwarding information. The home address, the homes of friends, the street number at home base, these are exact locations of exchange. The physicality of Olson's experience is conveyed in gestures of speech that confirm his admiration of Duncan's writing. They're even here exchanging manuscripts, reading each other's works closely, and this continues into the next two decades. The references to Pound, Rickheiser, and Gertrude Stein point to constellations of writing that permeate their creative junctures. The texture of their experience, references to family, friends, domestic scenes, give body and structure to what will open and expand in coming years as they both draw on their immediate living conditions as well as the shifting realities of the writing. The fullness of enthusiasm shown in these practical and brief notes give a sense of the energy Olson brought to acts of communication, acts ultimately in their friendship of love. And in many ways, I think of these as love letters, like not like in the way, you know, but that love, like they needed each other. They confirm each other's work and desires and, you know, in important ways. Much of the early correspondence focuses on publications and little magazines. Duncan's earliest extant letter to Olson is a magazine solicitation for the Berkeley Miscellany, a small journal he published at the time. Olson, in turn, puts his friend in touch with Sid Corman of Origin. Later, Olson arranges for Duncan's Song of the Border Guard to be published with cover art by Cy Twombly at Black Mountain College, where Olson becomes rector in 1951. Robert Creeley's editing of the Black Mountain Review, Jonathan Williams' publications through Jargon, John Wiener's little magazine Measure. I recently read the Wiener's letters that are going to come out in the next couple of years, and stunning, like, again, another, like, trajectory out around this material, and particularly in this, you know, thinking about the little magazines that are going on at the time. It's very interesting. Garrett Lansing Set. All are topics of exchange in the letters. And Duncan's very excited about Set, but it's like, holy shit, this is a guy. Who is this? Who is this guy, Garrett Lansing, writing to me about Osiris and Thoth? Oh, all right, I'm excited. Very excited. For them, it's a very exciting moment because this is Cold War. Academia is run by New Criticism, right? They feel very outside of the 1940s and 50s, and they're excited to find people doing stuff with mythology, the occult, with outsider traditions, right? And they're very, yeah, turned on by it. These are all topics of exchange in the letters, and both poets share information about their projects, poems, and publication trajectories throughout their correspondence. Indeed, Duncan helps put Olson in touch with Donald Allen, and in 1960, both authors published books through Allen's efforts at Grove. Olson's The Distances and Duncan's The Opening of the Field appear that same year, 1960, as the anthology in New American Poetry. So it's like a big year, right? So there, one of the things the letter can do is sort of show the trajectory. How do a couple of people who really love writing or into what they're doing find a larger public audience? And so the trajectory of that information exchange between small groups and larger public scenes takes place, and you can kind of watch that unfold in the letters. The letters show the social ties and commitments to bringing poems to a larger public sphere, and they show the affinities among poets and artists who confirm a new stance toward form at mid-century. Denise Levertov, Robert Creeley, Ed Dorn, Michael Rumaker, Helen Adam, Virginia Admiral, Joe Dunn, Larry Eigner, John Wieners, so many others, you know, they appear throughout the correspondence. Duncan and Olson test ideas and establish confidence in the work they share with each other and take risks as individual thinkers, performing for each other the thoughts and energies that drive them toward an understanding of breath and the body and the making of the poetic line. So I think I'll just I'll talk a little bit about a couple of instances in the correspondence and sort of Duncan's response, and then I'll end it just to give you kind of go in a little closer. Mostly in the 1950s. This is a famous scene, right? A particularly important moment, a fucking famous scene. The correspondence begins 1953, December 53, when Duncan, addressing near far Mr. Olson, puts forth the notion that poetry is a vehicle for the wisdom we seek. Duncan actually expressed this urgency a few months earlier in an essay, Pages from a Notebook, published in Claire Maul's The Artist's View. Olson quickly responds to Duncan, saying, "There is trouble with wisdom. It isn't a measure, and thus has to go." It's got to go, man. "From language, not knowing about art. For Olson, the imposition of values on form hinders poetry's advancement. This dispute brings to light a central element of his poetic stance. Individuals are secondary in the permitted documentations of the energy sustained by an acknowledged flow or movement of perception. Perception must be clear, open to a given moment. The goal is to see out into a world glimpsed only fleetingly. How do you see the world? You can't let your own subjective view interfere with that. You have to clear this shit out. You can't. I ain't a wise person. If you're wise, then what's the point, right? To hold closely to one's wisdom is to separate from the outer force of the world, to be entrapped by confidence, Herman Melville, and identification, rather than to be in vulnerable submission to outside forces or observable facts. Doesn't it, honestly, Olson argues, this is beautiful, come to love. That all springs up there, and that what springs up is energy, with which to do anything, think, which is to be wise, cut wood, and I mean for no other reason than to keep warm, push something ahead, make it different, etc., anything, all that, all the vocabulary, the words you seek to make gnomic by doublet, are valid enough as reductive, that is, that they do analyze validly the world's love opens one's eyes to." Olson goes on to explain that thinking is analytical, his quote, and is a quote, single statement, whereas this, writing is not thinking. Holy shit. Writing is not thinking. Writing is what love is. Life. That's very cool. All right. Writing is not thinking. Writing is what love is. For Olson, the act of writing participates in the active moment of perception open to any possibility. Writing should not impose one stamp of preconceived ideas or values. Value is associated instead with a willingness to give oneself completely to the creative demands of a given situation. Measures of durations of time and space are facts that guide Olson's position. And that a poem, this is Olson again, a poem is not wise, even if it is. That any wisdom also is solely a quality of the moment of time of that poem in which there are wisdoms. There are obviously seizures which have nothing to do with wisdom at all, and they're very beautiful. And I think he's writing to Duncan about the time he's also in a heavy, passionate correspondence with Francis Boldreff, and this stuff around Rimbaud in particular, and that correspondence is coming up. Like, I think there's a sense that these conversations are kind of blending in really interesting ways. I haven't done the work on that. I've just kind of started examining it, but it's an interesting way to think about Olson's thinking, because it is beautiful and passionate, and also acknowledge. It sounds like Rimbaud here in a way. Like, you can be seized by something, right? The poet can be seized, but not necessarily by wisdom. Fuck, you can be seized by all kinds of. And go sell guns in Africa. You know? The particular force of Olson's objection to wisdom is then elaborated publicly in his essay Against Wisdom as Such, 1954, which appears in the first issue of Black Mountain Review. So the private correspondence enters public debate, and Olson risks Duncan's goodwill as a forceful, in a forceful statement, right, that opposes him. He's like, This fucked, man. Back up. And Duncan, this is the moment Duncan could just say, like, ah, screw you. But he comes back, he's very generous to Olsen. In an August 8, 1954 letter, he announces right away, he says, I ain't going to rise in defense of my bewilderings. This matter of clarification is too important. I think about, like, how amazing is that? Like, if poets, I look at the poetry scene right now, and I think, like, if poets could just acknowledge when they feel like they agree with, you can acknowledge a disagreement, or even say that you're wrong, or just, like look at, it would be a better world. It would be an actual conversation rather than, like, stances over here and over there where you have to perform your whatever people feel like they have to perform, right? And Duncan generously, sweetly is just like, I get it, man. It's cool. Basically, in a much more elegant way. He says, I ain't going to rise in defense of my bewilderings. This matter of clarification is too important. He acknowledges Olson's claim to measure and love in poetry is a primary directing force of the poet's attention. He also makes some clarifications, though. He's not, which is fine. You can, like, it's like, dude. He observes, for motion to be free and energy is just here, the real must be distinguished from the unreal. I think this is reading in Coleridge, right? He's thinking about the Coleridge, the distinction between the fantasy and the imagination. But, you have to distinguish certain things here. Things must be discriminated and acknowledged. For Duncan, a problem exists regarding the ability of poetry to exact truth in the world. Volition, one's will, and validity, the truth value, can be at odds, particularly when engaged with potential conflicts of imagination. He writes, in made-up things, in the imagination, the will has range of a different kind. Words like genuine and false, truth and lie, up and down, where there is nor up nor down, as it's named, great and small, anything and everything we design. For Duncan, wisdom is not a presence or a position to claim subjectively in the composition of a poem, but is instead, as Olson argues, a measure that determines the truth in possibilities that senses discover. This is his quote, senses discover. The individual poet in the process of composition must come to participate in the larger generative possibilities that allow a poem into existence. Such process-based concerns include an awareness of language, conditions, and facts propelled by speech or authorial stance, all compelled by the energetic endowment of the moment, the place from which imagination enters new conditions of form. So that form, again, is secondary. It's like, what are the conditions of one's interest and concern, and how do you make that apparent to someone, right? So that you don't have to, like, memorize prosodic structures. You don't have to memorize, like, the whole literary tradition. Instead, you're like, you can take from that stuff, but, like, what is it we need right now to convey what's going on, what we're doing, what we are right here? So the next part I'll focus on just to kind of elaborate a bit more on their thinking around form, and then I'll kind of close it down. So in the spring of 1955, Duncan traveled with Jess Collins, his life partner, to Banyalbufar, Mallorca, where they remained off and on until February 1956. And this is right before Duncan also goes to Black Mountain to teach for a semester. The medieval iconography and architecture of Southern Europe provoked extended reflection on cultural energy and its cultural energy. And energy is something we can talk about also if we want to talk about. But in the how energy transmits formal structures, which is like not how a poet or a writer receives a tradition of form, but how the energy of a particular place and tradition produces form in an individual writer. Duncan's interest in the medieval period began at Berkeley under Kantorowicz in the Civilization of Medieval or Middle Ages program. His journey with Jess to Spain brought Duncan close to the architecture and iconography that ultimately led him toward an expanded theorization of his own poetic practice as it confronted Olson's. The discussion of form And this part begins when Olson responds point by point to Duncan's essay, Notes on Poetics Regarding Olson's Maximus. For Olson, the German naturalist Ernst Haeckel, his distinction between ontogeny, the development of an individual organism, and phylogeny, relationships among groups or individuals of organisms in evolutionary history, is crucial for understanding individual transformation. All this, so they have this big conversation about Haeckel. Haeckel's a German a biologist, and he comes up with this notion that, you know, the ontogeny and phylogeny. Phylogeny is sort of the long-term evolutionary change, right? It's like, you know, how an organism from over millennia can adapt and transform to its environment. And or to put it in literary terms, you know, how does a sonnet from Petrarch to Shakespeare, or Shakespeare to Ted Berrigan, go through various pressures and transformations? It's got 14 lines and 10 syllables roughly, right? Versus ontogeny, which is the individual assertion of change within that long period, right? So what does the individual bring energetically into that received form, right? So that's kind of what they're talking about. And it's a really interesting moment, particularly when we're talking about field poetics and open verse forms. And this is the place in the letters. I mean, I think in the Creeley letters they talk about it, but the Duncan Olson exchange is like really country simple. Like Duncan's in Majorca looking at this Gothic art and getting really turned on by it. And he's noticing it's an eruption of a kind of energy within the form of, like, you know, paintings of Jesus and Mary and the babe, and, you know, nursing, or crucifix scenes and shit, right? And he's like, how different it is in the 12th century, say, or 11th, like, versus the Renaissance, which is starting to formalize it in a way that's kind of like just, it's sort of rote and received. You're kind of like used to it, and it's like, whatever. Right? So and they're sort of thinking about poetry in this sense. Right? How do you make poetry alive and energetic and active and important and interesting, rather than just like, oh, here's another goddamn poem. All right, I want to read this. You know, like, yeah. How do you not be bored? Right? It's kind of. But anyway, it's interesting that Olson's drawing on these different, you know, terms. Haeckel. It was important. I still think it's an important metaphor thinking about art, and he's drawing not on literature but on science. And so, you know, how does the individual form interrupt, how does individual form, the ontogeny, right, interrupt and alter received cultural traditions? I think that's a big question. The interests of both Duncan and Olson, you know, focus on existing figures of art in relation to historical periods when the motivating influences of culture shifted the terms of production and value. Writing on August 14th, 1955, on the difference between medieval art and the new humanist Renaissance emphasis of the, Duncan observes, wherever the spatial knowledge does not exist, the iconography does not exist. The images are not signs with the Renaissance. Everything is lost of the order. The icons are humanized and become idols. The terror and majesty of the Romanesque is superseded by piety and luxury. It's like, fuck. Basing, and you think about that in terms of poetry, it's like piety and luxury, my God. That describes half the poetry scene right now. Basing these insights on his, or more than half, basing these insights on his viewing of the apse of Santa Maria de Tahul in Barcelona, Duncan maps historical emergences of creative energy onto his own poetic affinities with Olson and Creeley. He says, the created thing, then, is now emerges from the thing seen, the painter's necessary book. The thing embodied is a sign in the thing seen / heard. The book, the word, and the letters, the word emerges from vowels and consonants, and the thing is heard, the musician's necessary book, and hence hear the trumpet, the harps, and lutes. Olson, however, moves the question of form back to the location of individuals, away from things seen / heard, to insist on those, quote, those energies which you at that moment are. Those energies that you at that moment are. For Olson, a question persists. When is a transformation possible to the reductive materials? 4 question marks in the letter. The understanding of form as it is worked out in the Majorca letters combines a respect for artifacts and an acknowledgement not only of cultural or historical shifts, but of the many interacting and conflictive energies that shape the motives of individuals to use the given cultural material. Christ Pentacritor, whose image is Christ Pentacritor is like the image of Christ with the Alpha and Omega, and he's in a very medieval sort of Christ figure from Santa Maria de Tahul, reaches out to the present as a sign for Duncan and Olsa, a sign, not a symbol. I mean, they make this distinction. They're not like symbolizing human experience. They're just signs pointing directions to information, to knowledge, to moments of cultural history. You know, this is, or a measure, like that that Oaken puts, as Olsen puts it. A word is a speed. Olsen writes this August 21st, 1955. A word is a speed which fuerza, force, hath, happen, the great bodied spirit is. The book is what we make. There's something about that energy, speed, perception, not like trying to symbolize one's experience, but to just be in it, I think. That's what they're getting at. Now, just a little bit to talk about the lectures, because I think Duncan in the lectures on Olsen after he dies, I think also elucidates or gives us a way to think about these conversations that are happening in the letters, particularly in this notion of what he calls an interface. And I think the interface is an interesting model insofar as we're also using the notion of the interface of the machine all the time, as it's algorithmically determined in our lives these days. In a lecture on Olsen's poetry delivered at the University of Iowa in 1979, Duncan described poetry as an interface between himself and the world. Poetry, as he used it, acted as a point of mediation. For Duncan, the tension between the self and its environments was great. His understanding of poetry was diffused through spiritual, psychological, creative, scientific, intimate, and communal realities. Only in the play of poetry could all of these be joined in a pursuit of meaning, wedged into new formal conditions framed by the act of writing, the action itself. Duncan could not simply express what he felt he had to say. Instead, he obeyed the conditions of the poem's interface to access multiple formal physical environments interacting in his creative encounter. The poet's personal inheritance of diction and speech and the lexicographic occurrences in the mind and mouth were transcribed by hand to the page. There were histories of uses of words to consider, too, in his tonal registration of vowel and syllable. Duncan encountered a shifting English prosody reaching back to Chaucer and to other European authors who contributed to the formation of our tongue. All of these approaches to the interface mattered to Duncan, as did the public acknowledgement of his homosexuality, the professed identity and identification with a body of feeling he accepted and explored without hesitation through the dense architectures of poetry. In a 1979 lecture devoted to Olsen, whose essay Projective Verse articulated the powerful forces involved in modern processes of poetic composition, Duncan observed the following. This is all Duncan. The ways in which we come into a place where there's an interface, receiving and sending, hearing and sounding. Dante says man's deepest purpose is to have a hearing. The reason he creates language is to have a hearing. And I would add that we imitate with the sounds of our mouth speaking because the universe speaks to us, and yet we feel it needs a hearing. He's clearly listen to this wisdom conversation 20 years earlier, too. And yet we feel it needs a hearing. The universe needs a hearing because as we love it, we seek it. We go out and seek it, which must mean in this reciprocity that throughout the universe, every part needs a hearing. It's not idle curiosity that we have never been allowed to go as in every depth of that universe. And yet always, always with the terrible presence of an appetite that must also be throughout the universe. Here, Duncan expands the concept of the interface to include a cosmology where human action and desire function as only one small portion of a much larger interaction of forces. A poet's outlook or attitude toward the written work is but one force involved in an intense field of possibilities. Hearing and sounding in poetry enlivens aspects of a world otherwise diminished in the ongoing flux of everyday reality. It's not that a poet must be responsible to every element of the universe in poetry, but that poetry can be used to acknowledge appetite, not message. Poetry permits curiosity, not strategic planning. It encourages receiving and sending, not directing or holding forth as the compositor of meaning. Duncan finds agency in the poem. It does not reside in the poet, who is a conduit instead of impulses and disciplined attention to environments a poem brings into being. In his letters with Olson, too, Duncan often turns to advances in music to create analogies for his work in poetry. And again, thinking about the sense of the interface. I think he's really drawn to Stravinsky, and Paulina Oliveros. It's a way to think about how form mediates the desire, the intensity, the love of the author, the poet, the musician, and the exchange with the world outside. So he especially turns to Igor Stravinsky and Pauline Oliveros as models of open form exploration. And the work of Black Mountain poets often can be associated with the formal explorations of composers and dancers like John Cage and Merce Cunningham, or visual artists like Robert Rauschenberg and Willem de Kooning, all of whom spent time at Black Mountain College. Open form and diverse media at mid-century gave opportunity to explore the dimensions of post-war subjectivities that came into contact with the exhilarating and terrifying new realities of Cold War North American social circumstances, that raving mania that Duncan said a nation is. And, you know, I'm also playing the raving mania. It's like, it's not, I mean, people complain about the current situation, but it's like, it hasn't exactly changed a whole lot, right? It's been kind of going on. What are we to make of this correspondence? And that's a serious question. I spent a lot of years of my life going through this thing, and I was like, why does it matter? Is it just an archived thing that's going to go in a library shelf and be left? I don't want it to be. I think it's a real deal. What are we to make of this correspondence? I return to kind and kin, to the circle of the beehive, against the mania that a nation is. How do we nurture environments of our own making and enable the possibilities of our expressed desires to animate the living circumstances we choose? For me, personally, and I believe for Duncan and Olson, poetry acts as a site of transformative making. To use the words of Stanley Cavell, poetry provides a space of acknowledgement of others. It enables multiple designs of the self to cohere and disintegrate in the material reality of words. The prints and pathways our words leave behind show others potential uses in a long passage of literary and cultural forms encountered in moments of the everyday, not hierarchized, cataloged, or imposed by outside authority. Duncan and Olson subverted the literary models of advancement available to them by shaping their own publishing opportunities through a combination of private and public outlets. At all times, their work makes a space for a diversity of perspectives, requiring only that a writer acknowledges who they are, where they are, and how they are in precincts of their creative outlooks. I think this is one reason Amiri Baraka was so drawn to Olson particularly. The reception of Black Mountain by Black artists starts with this acknowledgement of self as receiver and projector of the tightly wound conflicts that shape national discourse. How do we transform national discourse through poetic undertakings? In what ways can we acknowledge the force of public agendas on our public or on our private pursuits, judgments, and arts? Poets cannot be separate from the nation, nor must they speak as its representatives. But there is a fluidity of movements between the poet and the nation. Baraka required a commitment to personal and cultural history, the terms and mythologies that were unique to African Americans, with emphasis in the 1970s on the philosophical, religious, and mythological realities of Africa, all with an eye to those European positions of mind imbricated through the devastating experience of slavery. I'm thinking particularly of Baraka has this book, In Our Terribleness, that came out in 19... It hasn't been anthologized. It's like a little, I don't know, 70-page book with photos in it. And it's a beautiful combination. It was like written for black communities, 1970, as he's building these towers in Newark, New Jersey. Like, what, trying to build homes for African Americans, right? And it's like a combination of diatribe, didactics, poetry, prose. It's a really polemic stuff. It's a really interesting mix of all of these things. I think that Olson's kind of getting. It's not an artful presentation. It's just a necessary presentation in a particularly potent political moment. White writers faced different pressures in a refusal of attitudes and assumptions of racial power exported with 16th, 17th, 18th century African labor, African and European labor. Particularly, the Enlightenment establishment of racial dominance that served white structures of feeling into the present moment continues to require poetic and social investigation at the roots of language and image, the joint streams where attitudes find rough articulation in the gestures of everyday speech and social actions. There's also a sense of fearless self-engagement, an acknowledgement of one's affinities and personal histories as they play out within a larger commons. Duncan and Olson ask, how do we listen at the interface of ourselves within the mania of the nation? How permeable is the beehive? To what extent do we make ourselves available to the images and words that form the textures of our art? I mean, that's a hard fucking question. Nathaniel Mackey observes a particularly controversial and troubling moment in the Olson biography. When in 1965 Olson was asked to give a poetry reading at UC Berkeley, he instead drunkenly extemporized for 3 hours. Duncan, a key organizer of the conference, eventually left the room. He had to pee. And the performance remains a startling event in Olson's biography. Was he a drunk, a fool, an egomaniac? A domineering white male blusterer absorbing all the attention in the room? Nathaniel Mackey has this to say. He says, the sense of poetry as something like a form of penance makes it a matter of conscience. His way of sublimating or attempting to sabotage his birthright, Olson's birthright, the complex of privileges and guilts we can, with a miri baraka called white karma. At the Berkeley conference, Olson makes an interesting remark. He says, I'm the white man. I'm that famous saying, the white man, the ultimate pale face, the non-corruptible, the good, the thing that runs this country, or that is this country. And thank God. And in fact, the only advantage I have is that I didn't. His righteousness, what here he calls his advantage, consists only of abstention, of writing poetry in place of running the country. I offer this anecdote as a way to draw awareness to our inheritance of cultural forms and procedures. Our forms are often ruinous. What can poetry do to invigorate alternative realities to the one we are often embedded in? What happens when we understand that violence and despotism, not agonistic debate, shape the reality of the nation? Duncan and Olson, throughout their writing and correspondence, exemplify strategies of refusal of accepted cultural forms and instead seek to confirm the powers and abilities of their sense in the making of poems at the interface of themselves and the world they tried to know. Anyway, I appreciate your time tonight. This is trying to bring a lot of pieces together that came out of my work on these books, and you know, I'm happy to have a conversation if you're interested. And anyway, it's great to be in Gloucester again. Last time I was here, I stayed at Garrett Lansing's place, and for the Olson Centennial in 2010, and it's just so nice to be back. But anyway, appreciate your, yeah. Yeah. Shit. Feel better now. Yeah. It's hard to do all this.
It was great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And I don't know, the one thing I will say about these books, they're horribly expensive. They're $75 a pop. My goal is, the reason I've come here, I've been to several different places giving this talk, and I'm trying to get these books into libraries. Yeah. These are really library editions. New Mexico says that in the next, at this point, less than 12 months, it should be out in paper. So, so if you are in contact with your local libraries and can persuade them to buy copies of this, it'll help get these out in paper. The paperback edition will be much less expensive. Just my goal, because I think this should be just being regular people's hands. Yeah.
Do you have any intention of publishing this lecture?
Oh, this lecture? I'll work on it. Yeah. I've got versions of it. I'm trying to, I'll put it out there.
Do you teach this at university or college?
Yeah, Ryerson University in Toronto. So, it's like right downtown Toronto University. So, that's my day job. I wrote that. I started giving I gave this talk at San Francisco State back in February, and then Simon Fraser and a few other places. And so I'll get it out and publish it eventually.
It's a lot to digest.
Yeah. It's, believe me, I know. Right. I try to just get a little bit out there. Yeah.
Well, Phil, if you want to listen to it again, it'll be on the Writer Center's website.
Oh, that's right.
Recording it. So.
You think this is a lot to digest? You should listen to Duncan's lectures for 3 hours at a time. Like, there's no digesting. You're just scrambling to like keep up. Yeah.
So the debacle in 1965 Poetry Conference, did you notice in the correspondence any kind of a cooling between Duncan and Wilson? Does it go on directly after that?
You know.
Or is it a hiatus of any kind?
The letters are so, they just don't give up on each other. Because I was looking for that. You know, they come back. They have, individually, they have some, like, interaction. So I was saying, while Duncan was at Black Mountain teaching, right, Duncan taught at 8 in the morning. Olson, like, ran his class until, like, 2 or 3 in the morning. So the students were always, like, just out of their and they did it. Olson did this, they both did this purposefully, right, kind of to the point where Duncan wrote a play called, like, The Adventures of Old Son. And, like, Old Son is this giant baby in diapers who this is performed at Black Mountain. It's a complete spoof of Olson, right? So clearly, interpersonally, they would have their disagreements. But people used to, they do that. But the correspondence, they just pick up. In fact, toward the end of it, like, Olson has this, like, heart attack in Berlin in 1967 or 68, and he writes Olson about it, or writes Duncan about it, and Duncan's just freaked out. He's like, shit. And it's like, I'm going to write to you every week. I'm going to be your sheepdog. I'm going to, like, be in touch with you. It's like, I just think they loved each other. And that's why I present this as a love correspondence, because it is. Like, regardless of whatever interpersonal reality, they loved each other. It's like family, right? You don't get along with certain, you have beefs. It's beautifully played out that the wisdom message thing, right? They acknowledge it and just kind of go on. It's like if the current poetry scene and the poetry scene forever could have just, I don't know. It's an example of how to be in possession of yourself and your diverse selves individually and still be true to yourself, others, and it doesn't have to be a war. It's not like a battle or anything. It's just like you figure
what was the year of the first letter? What was the year of the last letter?
1948 was the first letter. And the last one's 1969, a few months before Olson dies. So it's, yeah.
What astounds me, Dale, is 47, 48, on the dispensation of the new criticism.
Yeah.
Hear a Duncan and Olson talking about things, and look at the kinds of poetry that is being written by the poets that are considered to be the poets of America.
Yeah, exactly. Right, right.
At that time.
Yeah.
I mean, I was saying to Judy the other day, think about the poets on one side of Beacon Hill.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And Wieners.
No, it's...
And
it's a...
The poets on the other side of Beacon Hill at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
So there's stuff going on in academia. You know, I don't know if you all... do you know this? Dean Swift wrote a book published last year with FSG called The Bug House.
That's fabulous.
Yeah. About Pound and the Bug House.
I just reviewed it for Dispatches.
Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah.
I think it's the best book that's been written about Pound in many, many
It's
years.
A brilliant book for multiple reasons, right?
Yeah.
And one of them is that acknowledging the role of the institution in poetry, right? And how it's starting to get formed in this moment. Pound is one, putting people in touch with each other, but also multiple people from different disciplines are coming in. Academia is getting institutionalized in a very precise way. Mental health, I mean, John Wieners doesn't go to the same mental hospital that Lowell does, right? Yeah.
Right?
It's like that whole class, it's like a whole other, like, thing. It's really interesting.
That's right.
Yeah.
Measures is published, and didn't he lose his job at Harvard after Measures?
Right, right. No, it's amazing, right? So it's, I think about that, the role of the institution, academic, mentally, in terms of class, and Olson and Duncan are just like, they're nobody in this. I mean, Olson walked away from academia at Harvard, which he walked away from the Democratic Party. He had a big role in the Democratic. He could, after with Truman's election, he could have been like, I had a role in it, and didn't, right? Which is what Mackey, at the end, is referring to. He's like turned his back on this stuff. So like, what is it to turn your back on the institutions of American life after the war? And you know, this war really we're still, it's the same old thing. We're still grappling with it under different geographic, intrusions, right?
You know, for Olson, once Truman came in, it was the New Deal was over.
Yeah, it was done. It was cooked. Yeah,
we were in another place politically, phenomenologically, anyway.
All of it.
To look at it.
Yeah, and it's interesting. He saw that completely and just walked away.
Yeah, he absolutely did.
Yeah. So
you did.
Yeah. And so to see that and walk away from it, I mean, you're right. New criticism was the big in academia, right? So that by 1960, that's the thing. With part of the letters, to me, that's really interesting. Is that, and also it's in the lectures, like watching the move up to 1960 is really interesting because they're so outside of everything. And until by 1960, they've been in conversation with enough Ginsberg and the Beats and stuff, putting them in touch with people. So Grove Press and Harper, whoever it is, publishes this stuff. The Distances and Opening the Field are the big Grove Press publications that open them up to a larger world. But it's 12 years of them working by themselves.
It took many of us, Dale, years to discover the political ramifications of the New Criticism.
Yeah.
Although it preceded the Cold War, it really was the Cold War aesthetic, the Cold War ethos, those were the Cold War forms, this was the Cold War restrictions, the Cold War impressions. And we were drilled in this as undergraduates in the 1950s. If any one of our teachers had caught us reading Pound, which of course we read, or Williams.
Or Williams especially, yeah. Right, right. There was a study a couple of years ago about the creation of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and the relationship. The guy who ran it in the 50s had contacts with the CIA, and the production of a certain type of subjectivity through writing and all this kind of, there's a bunch of ugly stuff, right? And that's the thing. I mean, the to me, it's heroic what they're like risking just their livelihood and their lives to be in conversation and try to imagine a world, and they're having to invent this stuff from the ground up, which is amazing to me. Right? And that they can do it, and that they're not just being latched into a literary tradition, but looking, what, I mean, just down there at the library today, you look at Olsen's, he's reading everything from contemporary art and literature to everything, ancient Greek, Neanderthal, whatever. It's a range, it's a world, right? How do you be,
I mean, I'm an incomer, but I've been here 36 years, so this week I'm taking Tibetan Buddhist workshop.
Uh-huh.
So what does this have to do with all this? Because this man not only is a profound Tibetan Buddhist teacher, and he happened to have lived here as second home with his wife, and now he's teaching.
Who is it? Oh, I'm sorry,
his
who?
His name is Dan Brown, but yesterday was the 50th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's death, and he has been working on the conspiracy for 12 years himself. He works in the courts helping people who are abused sexually, emotionally, family, children, you know, these court cases investigating.
Yeah.
At the same time, he was involved with this because he met this Mexican fellow who was the, he delivered some food up to Robert Kennedy's room at the Ambassador Hotel, and then the next morning, after he spoke in the hotel, he was shot in the kitchen.
Okay, yeah.
They have proved through some stuff that was withheld by the CIA, talking about the CIA, that this recording that was left behind by some news person, they collected it off the floor, but they were not allowed to introduce it into any of the cases. It has finally been opened up after 50 years.
Yeah.
And because of the technology of sound equipment now, they were able to dissect the sound of the shootings.
Yeah.
And instead of 5 bullets, there were 13.
Yeah.
And some came from a different section. So they proved that Sirhan, even though he shot,
didn't
kill him. It was someone else, and one of them is a CIA agent. There was a woman in a polka dot dress. So this all came out, and now this man has an interview that has done, and you can Google it, Dan Brown.
Yeah.
And he'll talk about the whole conspiracy and what he found.
Yeah.
And it's all connected because it wasn't LBJ that supposedly got Jack Kennedy, and it may be Robert and Martin Luther King. I mean, this is, and you're talking about all this stuff, too.
Well, Ed Sanders is somebody who, like, writes about the Robert F. Kennedy assassination in really interesting ways, and coming out of this Olson tradition, right? And again, like, I don't know about all the stuff you're talking about, but like,
I hope I'm understandable, but it just doesn't stop.
I think the concern is, like, how do you look at the situation, look at the world you're in, and gather the information and be real toward it, right? So, like, the conspiracy part, like, I mean, what, like, how do we, given all of the chicanery, the raving mania that a nation is Duncan, like, how do we be real people in the world? I think is, to me, is the question. I think for Duncan and Olson, like, given the disputed facts of all the raving mania, right?
How do we? What are we fighting for? We all take causes. I'm signing petitions every day.
I think for them, it's like, how do we love, right? Yeah, so. Yeah.
Back to the idea of the sacrifices that Duncan and Olson made in the beginning of their career. There's that wonderful Maximus poem that begins, "I've sacrificed everything. And in the Berkeley reading, he talks about the conventional. Convent. You know, becoming almost monastic. Tough way to make a living.
Yeah, this is making a living. Olson got by, but.
Yeah.
And Duncan became, they both became, I mean, after 1960, that became easier for both of them in a way, right?
You sense that in the letters, too.
Yeah, I sort of struggle with that in the letter, because in one sense, Olson has a harder time than Duncan. Duncan becomes a very desired figure to go. He gives, I think, he gives hundreds of readings alone, like in 1963, 1967, right? He's just always out. And those readings were powerful money in those days for him, right? Olson, not as much, but he was, the Buffalo gig he had paid well, and but it was, yeah, it was hard. It wasn't like a permanent, like, yeah. But again, yeah, all these questions that we all, like, how do you live? How do you, it's all, so you see them struggling with that through the letters, which is another interesting, like, layer of the of this correspondence. I think I was funny, I was at a conference recently talking to someone doing work on the Olson Creeley correspondence, right? And you know, the Black Sparrow stuff I think is up till about 1953, so there's still like 1954 and 1970 hasn't even been published, another 10 volumes of stuff, right? And it'd be really interesting to see like how these all kind of pull together.
Where do you find these letters that you've edited fit into the entire spectrum of Olson and or Duncan correspondence?
Yeah.
There's the Blazer Duncan, the Blazer Olson things are coming out.
Yeah, yeah.
The Dawn Olson things have yet to come out.
Exactly, yeah.
It's almost endless. It must be Wieners, a fairly substantial Wieners Olson correspondence.
Yeah, the Wieners alone is... Yeah, there's about 500 pages of Wiener's letters that should be coming out probably in the next
couple of years. But the Dawn stuff has got to be endless too.
Yeah, and this is the thing. There's just way more. Like, there's so much of this stuff. This is finding the presses to do this. I think
plus the ones that are already out there to build off.
So
and the Dahlberg letters.
So the University of New Mexico Press that's been doing a lot of this work. They're already like 2 years, now they're 2 years out in terms of work that they've got coming out just on this stuff. And there's like, it's hard to find enough institutions to this work, I wanted to come out as a readerly edition, and the press just couldn't afford it. They're just like, we have to do it, So the reason I'm presenting these letters the way I'm doing it, because I'm really trying to advocate for presses and reader, we need more. This stuff, a lot of this stuff's forgotten. A lot of people don't care about any of this stuff. It's just not in the mind. Contemporary poetry, poets, they're wearing tuxedos to parties and stuff and doing like, these young kids. No, seriously, these young kids are like, there's some really hip young kids who have never read anything or a big deal, right? And it's all right, but. You know.
Yeah, and they're militantly defensive about the fact that they haven't read anything.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm trying to like bring this information out. Just try to excite people about this stuff in some way, right? That because we need presses to publish it, we need an audience to support it, we need libraries to collect it, right? Because what I was talking with Stephen and Henry earlier and other people, and it's like. The conversation they're having, Duncan and Olson are having, or Creeley and Olson are having, or Creeley and Wieners, like these are really interesting figures who pop up into this thing that's ongoing. It's still happening now, right? Like Plato in the Phaedrus calls it, Socrates through Plato, like, says, what philosophy really is just endless speculation, right? Oh, yeah, that's kind of what we're doing, right? We're just sort of figuring this shit out as we go. And different people pop up into the conversation, they fade out, and I'm really interested in like what they that particular conversation is really vital and interesting because they're very clear about it, right? They're not trying to impose their particular egos on it in this way that so that these different ways of processing that conversation can open up, and it's fascinating. You know, it takes a little scholar. My work as a scholar was to kind of go back and track down some of the. I mean, the references are rather 50 years old, and you have to kind of follow that stuff out. And, you know, but it's really a contemporary conversation, is how I hear it. So,
have you read the book, The Letters to His Wife, Betty? There's a whole book with correspondence. Do you know that one?
I don't know. To Betty, no.
I didn't read them, but I found them in the bookstore down in the village, and I called a book dealer up here.
Boulderoff.
Boulderoff.
Oh,
Francis Boulderoff.
Yeah, I read the Boulderoff letter.
I'm not aware of any letters to Betty.
Yeah, yeah. I don't.
Collected or published.
Yeah, not that I know. Yeah, Bulldruff. Yeah, I've read those. Oh yeah, and the Bulldruff. Yeah, I think you can. You can. I think that's an important card. The Bulldruff conversations.
Very important.
Yeah. Absolutely, I can hear it in the background of these letters to Duncan. Right? Yeah.
No, I picked up 20 of them because the man wanted them, and I schlepped them on the subway.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
When you think of all the letters that Olson wrote.
I don't know what he's doing. When do you have time to go get a beer at the like, the crow's nest or something?
You know, when the mail came,
yeah,
in the afternoon,
yeah,
it would be just bales. You're sitting at Olson's kitchen table. Bales.
They're just coming. It's amazing. Yeah.
he'd read them all to who was ever at the table.
Oh, that's
one
amazing.
Of the things about Duncan had the most beautiful calligraphy.
Yeah, yeah, I know it too well.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Yeah, he must have had incredible, yeah, mail coming in all over. Because, you know, you read the Wiener's correspondence simultaneously to this stuff. And also it's a very different tone and, like, yeah. different conversations were produced different, yeah, produced different voices. It's interesting. I was at a I gave this talk at University of Texas a few months ago, and this person very generously, genuinely, like, well, is Duncan ever kind of faggy in his conversation? Is he like, I'm like, no, he's in, there's no cat, like, there's no, like, he's very, it's like they live up to a kind, and it's a very different conversation with Creeley, very different with Wieners.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting. Like, they both they took on a kind of tone with each other in a way that for this is a book of discovery and support. And the lectures, Duncan's lectures on Olson are. It's a nice companion to the HD book because it's like, in one sense, it's an excavation of modernism. As it plays out post 1950, and it's also an interesting look at how projective verse and Olson's poetics, like, remain vital in Duncan's world from 1970 till he died in 88. Right, so yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah,
we'll be sure to get the Sawyer Free Library to. Snag
that. Yeah. Anyway, thank you. Yeah.
Thanks, Dale.
Yeah. So much. Yeah.